Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This past Saturday was the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of the 20th century's most important entertainers, Frank Sinatra. Like Will Rogers and Bing Crosby before him, Sinatra was an innovator in the business and a multimedia artist. He, more than anyone, developed the concept album. He perfected the sound of the great American songbook singer. He was among the first actors to have his own film production company and the first singer to have his own record company. He also had this Hollywood-type life story, rags to riches, a downfall, and a successful comeback. But most importantly, he had the voice. And that single attribute allowed his contemporaries, as well as his audience, to forgive a multitude of sins. His chip-on-the-shoulder attitude, his surliness, his indiscretions, his ties to mafioso and less-than-savory characters. It was all forgiven when he sang.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow, got the string around my finger. What a world.
My guest today is Sinatra biographer James Kaplan, whose two copious volumes document Sinatra's life. His first volume, Frank the Voice, came out in 2010. His second volume, Sinatra the Chairman, was released in October and begins with the comeback, winning the Academy Award for From Here to Eternity, and the release of this record we're hearing, the two of which put him back at the top. James Kaplan joins us today to talk about the life and legacy of Frank Sinatra. James Kaplan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it is a great honor and pleasure to be here.
Obviously, you've been talking a lot about Sinatra as the 100th anniversary has occurred, and you've spent so much time with Sinatra over the course of these two volumes. As I was reading through the book, I kept thinking of, I think it was Zoot Sims, the jazz man's Zoot Sims line about Stan Getz, the other jazz man. He said, he's a great bunch of guys. As I read this book, you know, Sinatra could be the kindliest person in the world. He could be generous to a fault, but he would explode at a moment's notice for no apparent reason, and the grudge would be held for years. He could be absolutely petulant. He could be ungenerous with his colleagues, with the people he worked with, and also generous with them. I mean, he was just a bundle of contradictions. What is it like to get to the heart of a person like that in a biography like this?
Well, it takes 1,700 pages. That's the long and short of it. I guess maybe the long of it. But it's true. He was a great bunch of guys. I think, as you were saying that, I was thinking that he wanted to be good. I think he wanted to be good. But so much was always getting in his way, and what was first getting in his way was his essential nature. You know, he was the only child of, first of all, he was an only child, and that was naturally lonely-making in itself. He was 13 pounds when he was born. His mother was under 5 feet, so I think she didn't want to go through that again. But he was an only child, and I think he realized from a very young age, he said in later years that when he was walking around Hoboken as a kid, he heard the music of the spheres, which sounds a little bit artsy-fartsy or airy-fairy, but I think it's really true, literally in this case. I think this guy was a musical genius of a Mozartian level, the kind of musical mind that comes along every 200 or 300 years. And that's a hard thing to carry around. And also, he had a mother who was totally unpredictable. He said later on that he never knew whether she was going to hug him or hit him. This was literally the case. His mom and dad ran a bar in Hoboken called Marty O'Brien's, and they had a little billy club behind the bar in case of trouble. But when Frank gave his mother trouble, Dolly would give him a whack with a stick. So it wasn't real good for his relationships with women later on, or really, I think, his relationships with anybody. I think he was distrustful about human relationships.
In the book, you contrast Frank Sinatra with Dean Martin, and you really use term for Dean Martin as a guy who just doesn't care. And Sinatra was sort of a mama's boy, and Martin was sort of a very macho, also similarly unable to get very close to anybody like Sinatra. I mean, they were similar in that regard, but there was sort of an ease about Martin. And Sinatra always cared what others thought about him, and there was a sort of a basic insecurity, and it was a really interesting contrast. How did you come up with these ideas between these two singers who were so closely linked?
Well, the way I got to Sinatra in the first place was through Jerry Lewis. You see, yeah. I did a profile, New Yorker profile of Jerry Lewis back in 2000. And then a couple of years later, Jerry asked if I would help him write his memoirs. And I instantly said yes. And we wrote this book called Dean and Me, A Love Story, about his partnership with Dean Martin. I learned a lot about Dean Martin in the process. And he was a fascinating guy, Dean was. Nick Tosches also wrote a wonderful and amazing book about Dean Martin called Dino, Living High in the Business of Dirty Dreams. That is a terrific book. He was a massive contradictions himself, but he was, it's interesting you called him macho because that's how he came across, but he did not intend to be macho. Dean Martin was like a big cat. He was like a big jungle cat, you know, a big lazy jungle cat. He loved to play golf. He loved the ladies. He loved to get in bed early with a comic book and watch a Western on TV. Very different from Frank Sinatra. He thought that Frank took everything way too seriously. And clearly, we listened to Dean singing, and you can hear that this was a guy who was very gifted. It didn't take his own singing seriously enough. But there's kind of something wonderful about when you hear Dean Martin singing Ain't Got a Kick in the Head, the great Sammy Cahn, Jimmy Van Heusen number. Frank couldn't really have brought that off the same way Dean did. You know, there's something so, it's like catnip. It's so funny, that song. Frank idolized Dean Martin. Dean was everything Frank was not. He was big, strong, handsome, and he was funny as hell. And Frank tried to be funny on stage. He never could really bring it off.
And that was also an essential part of his singing, his stage banter, and how he dealt with people in his life, which this comes through time and time again. Even if he's being very friendly, there's this underlying current of anger that could erupt at any time. And it always made people nervous. Everyone you talked with says, you know, you just never knew what was going to happen with him because that was sort of an essential part of his personality.
Not only essential part of his personality, Rich, but an essential part of his charisma. Those laser blue eyes, you know, they convey charm, they convey danger at the same time. And the danger was inside him. He was a deeply insecure man. And we really all have to beware of insecure people, especially when they're as powerful as Sinatra. Everybody around him kind of tiptoed. Almost everybody was terrified of him. There were a couple of exceptions. The comedian Shecky Green was never scared of Frank. One time when Frank got drunk and kind of abusive, Shecky Green, who was built like a fullback, told me he just slung Frank over his shoulder and took him back up to his hotel room on the bed to sleep it off. But most people were not that way. Most people, when Frank barked, they jumped.
Yeah. Now, the second volume, Sinatra the Chairman, the new book, starts literally, as he's winning the Academy Award, he's made the great comeback. He had seemingly lost his voice, lost his sort of way, lost his contract with MGM. He'd lost his Columbia recording contract. But as you pick up the book, he's back on top. He lobbied hard for the role of Maggio in From Here to Eternity.
And Ava Gardner got it for him, not a horse's head in the movie.
But he's back on top. But what's really interesting is that through that first part, he's busy selling old scores from people who sort of looked the other way when he was down on his luck. He was being loyal to the people who had helped him sort of climb back up. It's a really interesting, complex story.
It is, and he was a guy who, even as he gained enormous power through the 1950s into the 60s and 70s, was always kind of scanning the horizon for enemies, and he had plenty of them. And again, you're right, plenty of people who deserted him when he was down and out.
You mentioned Ava Gardner, and one of the things this book makes clear is for people who have sort of know Sinatra's career, they know of the great love affair with Ava Gardner and how so many of the Torch songs seem to be written about Ava Gardner, or there seemed to be that sort of longing in there. But what I was unaware of is how long this sort of mostly off but occasionally on relationship went. It went for years.
Well, it was really kind of apart from maybe the 2 years or 2.5 years when the relationship began in 1948. The relationship was really all about collapse and then distance. And then what it really became for both of them was an idea in the mind, kind of this imagined thing, this ideal. for Sinatra, Ava was the woman he could never conquer. She was the gal that got away. And he was sort of the guy who got away for her, too. They were very similar people, Ava and Frank, in so many ways. And they were kind of like an unstable chemical compound. You know, they could never truly bond. But once they split up for good, and that really happened in about 1953, and they stayed married until 1957, but they had really split up. They were on the phone all the time with each other. They wrote to each other. There was this ideal floating in the air that they could have been so great together. But the truth is they couldn't have in reality.
Of course, the book sort of moves around between his film projects, his many recording projects. And what really becomes apparent is this is a guy that was like burning the candle at both ends for a good part of the 50s and 60s, where he is just bouncing around. And everybody knows the stories about how Frank Sinatra would stay up and party all night and then come up the next day and do more shows or show up for a film and maybe not give his best. But this seemed to be sort of a big part of his makeup, as this sort of, I've got to be busy all the time.
Yeah, he was like a flea on a frying pan. This was his nature. This was stamped into his character. He was pathologically impatient, much like his mother, Dolly. This is a guy who just always had to be on to the next thing. I heard an amazing story from one of the dozens upon dozens of people I interviewed, a guy who was his houseman in later years in Palm Springs. And he was telling me just a run-of-the-mill story about picking Frank up at the Palm Springs airport after Frank had done a concert in Vegas at Caesar's Palace. He flies his private plane back, plane lands at Palm Springs airport, taxis up the taxiway. Frank skips down the staircase, gets into the car. The houseman, Bob, is at the wheel. Frank gets into the passenger seat and bangs on the dashboard. Bam, 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 bam. Let's go, let's go, let's go. That was his whole life. That was Frank. He just always had to be to the next thing.
And really, it didn't serve him well in most of his movies, which movies are a slow, deliberate process, even though that there's long hours and lots, but there's a lot of waiting around and there's a lot of preparation.
He hated it.
And he hated that.
But
he was capable, when he respected the director, of giving really fine performances. But you never knew when it was going to happen or what the material was that he was going to work on. Man with the Golden Arm was one example with Otto Preminger, which he felt like he always should have got an Oscar for. So what was it when he would really settle down and work, as opposed to being the one-take Charlie that he was a lot of times in movies and even occasionally in his recordings?
Yeah, well, you said it exactly right. He worked well when he respected the director, but this was infrequent. And it really only happened big time with three directors. There was Fred Zinnemann on From Here to Eternity. There was Preminger on Man with the Golden Arm. And then there was the great John Frankenheimer in The Manchurian Candidate, a movie that holds up so beautifully. Other than that, though, Sinatra really felt that the movies were an engine of his fame. They were means to an end. And he really threw all his strongest efforts and his most tenacious and patient efforts into his recordings. He would not, occasionally in a recording session, he would say, "You got it. That's the best I can do. Good night," and walk out. But a lot of the time, he would do 10, 15, even up to 20 and more takes. That great "I've Got You Under My Skin" was 22 takes.
Yeah. And you tell some new stories about that. The stories have been told many times about how that arrangement came about with Nelson Riddle basically getting a call saying that they needed three more songs. And he wrote "I've Got You Under My Skin," the orchestration and arrangement, in the passenger seat of the station wagon with a part of the dining room table as his desk.
And with a leaf from the table on his lap and a flashlight in one hand, while his wife Doreen drove him to the recording studio for that nighttime recording. It's wild. It's wildness. And Riddle, we have to name check Riddle here and just remind everybody what a towering genius he was and how incredibly fortunate Sinatra was to find him and work with him.
And on that recording, you mentioned it was something like 20-something takes, which was even large by Sinatra standards. Do you feel like he knew something, or there was something special about this particular song? I mean, this was coming at the end of a couple of weeks of recording, the last song on the album, if you will.
And 1 or 2 a.m., and poor Milt Bernhardt, the trombonist, had he had blown his lungs out. He had given everything he had. And it was like Count Basie says in April in Paris, one more time, right? They had to do it one more time. And a little Milburn Hart was standing on a seltzer box so he could get the trombone up near the microphone. And he was Bob Bain, the guitarist who was on that session and who my interview told me that poor Milburn Hart was completely soaked with sweat. And he thought he had given all he had got to give, but somehow he made it even better for that 22nd take.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little bit of I've Got You Under My Skin. This is the work of Frank Sinatra. My guest today is a biographer, essayist, and journalist, James Kaplan, author of Sinatra, The Chairman, published by Doubleday. Here's music from Sinatra and Riddle and Cole Porter. I've Got You Under My Skin.
Sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near. In spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats how it yells in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Why not use your mentality? Step up, wake up to reality. Time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop just before I begin, 'cause I've got you.
That's music by Frank Sinatra. My guest today is Sinatra's biographer. Sinatra the Chairman is the name of the book. My guest is James Kaplan, celebrating the 100th anniversary of Frank Sinatra. And you tell an awful lot of stories in this huge biography, everything from the mafia ties, his role in the Kennedy campaign. He played an essential role in delivering Illinois, did he not, for the Kennedy campaign in 1960?
Well, I think that through his great and good friend, and I say that with some irony, through Sinatra's pal, the head of the Chicago Mafia, Sam Giancana, yes, a lot of perhaps second votes or votes from people who had been underground in the grave for a long time were delivered to John F. Kennedy in some precincts around Chicago, thanks to Mr. Giancana. Mr. Giancana expected something in return from the Kennedy. He expected something that he thought Sinatra had negotiated with the Kennedys, a relief of Justice Department pressure on the mafia and on Sam Giancana in particular. He didn't get it, and he got very, very angry at both the Kennedys and at Frank Sinatra.
It's been reported elsewhere, and in the book, you suggest that maybe Giancana was somewhat considering a hit on Sinatra, or at least doing some significant damage to him, but he loved the voice.
He loved the voice, that's right. He, an important associate of Giancana's, a gangster named Johnny Formosa, seriously proposed whacking Sinatra for failing to come through on the bargain. And Sam Giancana was one evening enjoying a pleasant interlude with his lady friend, the singer Phyllis McGuire. And like so many other couples who listened to Sinatra while they were making love, they were listening to Frank Sinatra. And Giancana thought to himself, how could I ever still that voice? How could I ever end that voice? I can't do it. And so, helping Sam Giancana with his lovemaking saved Frank Sinatra's life.
But there was a bit of a payback. I mean, he did maybe some nefarious things around Cal Neva that sort of caused Frank Sinatra some trouble.
Well, there was an absolute payback, and Sam Giancana made sure of it. He got Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr. to perform for free for 3 weeks at a shady nightclub north of Chicago called the Villa Venice. It was also an off-the-books gambling establishment. They had a whole secret casino in a Quonset hut next to the near the nightclub, and it was all rigged. All the roulette wheels, everything was rigged. The craps table was all rigged, just to milk the suckers as much as they could. And meanwhile, Sinatra and Dino and Sammy were drawing the suckers in.
Yeah, and they performed 3 weeks for no pay. The FBI eventually becomes aware, and they're interviewing people. And Sammy Davis Jr. had a great retort, did he not?
The FBI interviewed, shall we say, Sammy in his Chicago hotel room about what might have been going on at the Villa Venice. And Sammy Davis essentially said, "I'm going to tell you something, baby. I got one good eye, and I want to keep that one good eye. So I'm just going to keep my mouth shut."
I want to ask about the 1971 retirement. This seems so strange. I guess he was seeing himself descending. He was not relevant in pop culture as much during this particular time. What led to the retirement?
Well, I think you have to take the whole time in context and Sinatra's life in context. Through the middle 60s, rock and roll destroyed the popular music business as Sinatra had known it. There were a lot of his colleagues who lost a lot of work. Mel Torme seriously considered becoming a commercial airline pilot after the Beatles cratered the business. Sinatra survived. He held on because Sinatra was Sinatra. But there was a lot about that era that was very upsetting to him. Huge amount of turbulence in the United States, protests against the war. Sinatra began to become more politically conservative. He tried to accommodate to the new music. He tried to record some of the new tunes. A lot of it didn't come off very well, didn't sell. This album called Watertown, a kind of a singer-songwriter type album, very low-key, and it didn't even move the needle on the sales charts. All this was upsetting to him. He was aging too. He had hit 50. He had hit 55. He didn't look the way he had looked before. He was making fewer movies, making fewer albums because the albums were discouraging. And he had this marriage to Mia Farrow that imploded very quickly. He was discouraged. He was tired. He thought he'd go to the desert and paint and play golf, but he quickly realized that the world needed Sinatra and he needed the adulation. And so that retirement lasted about 5 minutes. In reality, about a year and a half, but right. Not much longer than that.
And yet he had another peak later in life when he becomes sort of like this spokesman for the Great American Songbook in a way.
Yeah.
And also his outside personality. Sorry. Yeah.
I was going to say that he really anticipated. He's really ahead of his time. You talk to young musicians today, and what they all tell you is they can't sell records anymore. You don't make money selling records. The only way you can make money these days is by going on tour. And that was what Sinatra learned after he came back from retirement. He wasn't really selling records. He became purely a concert artist after 1973. And that was where his bread was buttered. That was where his strengths lay. And so he wasn't really making movies anymore, not turning out many albums. He went on the road. He was playing the big venues where he could sell a lot of tickets and make a lot of dough. He was wearing a tuxedo. And the bulk of his repertoire, he threw in a few new numbers, but the bulk of his repertoire was the repertoire that he had made great beginning in the mid-1940s, as you said, the American Songbook.
Now, when we think back of Sinatra's great accomplishments, he had a couple of really fine classic movie roles, some classic albums, and an evolving sound, which sort of changed with every orchestrator and arranger. And we should mention the great songwriting team of Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen.
Yeah.
He seemed to surround himself with these people that really made him shine.
He knew talent when he saw it. He revered musicians, and he especially revered great musicians. His first musical idol was Bing Crosby. His second musical idol was Tommy Dorsey. He loved the guys who played. He made sure the guys who played on his recording sessions were the cream of the crop, the very best musicians there were. He made sure that the songwriters whose material he did were the best. And yes, Sammy Kahn, Jimmy Van Heusen became essentially his house songwriters from 1955 for the next 15 years or so. Sammy Kahn continued to write special lyrics for Sinatra until the end of his career in 1995.
Well, he also developed the concept album. Really, he was. There were other concept albums maybe a little earlier, but he really developed the idea of the concept album.
Well, there were other thematic albums. For instance, you could, in the mid-1940s, you could buy an album of Hawaiian music or Czechoslovakian songs. But Sinatra developed this idea, beginning in his Columbia years, of an album that revolved around a particular mood, a spirit. And throughout those great Capitol years in the 50s, he tended to alternate light and dark, upbeat albums, and then moody, meditative, sometimes melancholy albums.
He's also one of the first actors, sort of among the first actors, in these first wave of actors that basically were setting up their own companies and sort of grabbing power for themselves as opposed to working for somebody else.
That's right. He had his own production companies, produced his own movies. The paradox, Rich, was, as you noted before, the more he controlled a movie, the worse the movie was. His best movies were really controlled by strong and skillful movie makers.
Well, like I said, you've spent so many years looking over this material. What is your assessment? Where are we going to think of? Are we still going to remember and really think of Frank Sinatra 50 years from now, another 100 years from now? Do you think he has that? You mentioned he was sort of Mozartian in his way. And there are numerous stories where he could take complex scores, hear it once, and know every single moment of that music in a sort of musical genius way. What do you think people are going to think 50, 100 years from now about Frank Sinatra?
Well, genius is a funny word, and it's thrown around a lot, and it's kind of an intellectual word. I would suggest something more visceral, closer to the gut. And what I would say is this, that you can talk about Sinatra's amazing phrasing. He learned, I think, a lot of how he told the story from Mabel Mercer and from Billie Holiday. You can talk about his incredible breath control, a lot of which he learned from Tommy Dorsey. And you can talk about the way his reverence for the written word and the way he studied those lyrics until he lived inside them. But I think ultimately what will make him endure is a mystery. It's kind of an X factor. And it's this quality that he was able to project of when you hear Sinatra singing a song, he is making you think, making you feel that he is thinking these thoughts and feeling these feelings in the second that he's singing them. This great feeling of absolute immediacy that no other singer, there are a lot of great voices out there, but think about them. No other singer really projects that quality. It's the thing that still gives me goosebumps every time I hear Sinatra sing. And I think a lot of people feel the same way, young, middle-aged, and old, and I think people will continue to feel that way. I think it's that X factor, that strange mystery quality that's going to make his voice endure through the decades and even the centuries.
All right. Well, James Kaplan, we appreciate your time today. The name of the new book is Sinatra, the Chairman. It's published by Doubleday. Thanks very much for joining us.
My great pleasure, Rich. Thanks for having me.
Biographer and journalist James Kaplan speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the author of the 2-volume biography of Frank Sinatra. Frank the Voice came out in 2010, documenting the first half of his life. Sinatra the Chairman was published earlier this year by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Look down, look down that lonesome road before you travel on. Look up, look up and seek your maker before Gabriel blows his horn. Weary toting such a load, trudging down the lonesome road. Look down, look down that lonesome road before you travel on.